This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's been 2 years since President Biden signed the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill into law. Wisconsin has received $5.6 billion of that funding to fix roads and bridges and also to improve access to broadband and clean water, renovate airports, and more. How is that funding being used in Wisconsin 2 years down the road? Tammy Baldwin has represented Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate since 2013. I talked to Senator Baldwin yesterday about new projects in our state that are funded by the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Now, you've been talking the last couple days about the anniversary of this bipartisan infrastructure bill. What kind of things are we starting to see in Wisconsin as a result of that bill?
Well, as you know, when we were working on the bipartisan infrastructure law, we were defining infrastructure quite broadly. Certainly, it includes things like roads and bridges and transit, but it also included an investment in our water infrastructure, as well as the build out of our access to high-speed broadband, with the goal that we would have every household, every business in Wisconsin connected to high-speed broadband as the bill is fully implemented. So when I look back over the last 2 years, simply put, this bill is working and it's making a difference in the lives of Wisconsinites. From a business who now has high-speed internet to a household or a school that has safe and clean drinking water, these investments are making our communities safer and people healthier and our economy stronger.
Before we look at some specific projects, there was some concern that from some critics of the legislation on the Republican side that this stretched the concept of infrastructure. They wanted to see more focus on, you know, the roads and the bridges and some of those things they thought might be better tackled elsewhere. Can you make the case for that slightly more expansive vision of infrastructure?
Absolutely. You know, the idea that when you turn on the faucet at your home, that you are getting safe and clean drinking water is critical. It's absolutely critical. And we still have many areas of the state where there are lead pipes in the water systems and therefore the potential for contamination. We also have places in Wisconsin where there's PFAS contamination, where there's farm runoff and other things that are dangerous in our drinking water system. And so I'm very proud that we had a broad view with regard to investing in water infrastructure, as well as, you know, the traditional transportation infrastructure we think about. And then, you know, broadband is perhaps one that was most critiqued by opponents of moving forward with a big infrastructure investment. But boy, if the pandemic taught us nothing else, it's that we really need access to high-speed internet services to be a part of a 21st century economy. And whether that was people relying on the internet for work, for telehealth, for school, people really needed access to high-speed internet, and those who didn't have it really suffered. And so I'm really proud of the investments and having this broad vision of what a 21st century infrastructure looks like, especially after so many years and decades of neglect.
On the other hand, there were concerns from climate advocates that the infrastructure bill didn't do enough to try to bring down carbon emissions. What would you say to that? Was there some stuff there? Are there other things you've seen in subsequent legislation that might answer those concerns?
Yeah, so it's such a great question, because the infrastructure law began to lay a foundation for clean transportation. And so we had a commitment to electric vehicle charging so that we could have a network of EV chargers across the state and, frankly, across the interstate system. There was an investment in public transit, which takes more cars off the roads, and clean buses to help communities transition from combustion engine buses to electric buses. So it laid a foundation. But since that time, We have passed the Inflation Reduction Act. And in the Inflation Reduction Act, we've made the single biggest investment in transition to a clean and renewable energy sector than we've ever made or that any country has ever made. The projection is that by 2030, we will have reduced our carbon emissions by 40% because of the investments made in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's not enough, but it's a start, and it's the boldest start of any country so far.
Let's dig into what a lot of people think of when they think of infrastructure, the roads and bridges. Now, coming through a Wisconsin summer, we're used to seeing construction. We might not connect the dots to legislation passed a couple years back. What kind of projects are we funding here in Wisconsin using this infrastructure legislation from a couple years ago?
Well, again, so many things, but I know that as I travel the state a lot. I crisscross the state to try to see my constituents where they're at. And I do see a lot of major construction projects that I know are being funded by the bipartisan infrastructure law. In my hometown of Madison, we have an extensive project underway right now relating to bus rapid transit. And we see a lot of our major thoroughfares in this city being upgraded. We know later this year or early next year, funding for six bridges in the John Nolan Drive stretch that construction will be underway because those bridges see 40,000 cars a day, and they are deemed, overdue for reinforcement. So those are the type of things we're seeing. We are applying for, and I hope to hear in the near future that we will be able to get bridge funding, significant bridge funding to address a very significant bridge that connects the city of Superior with the city of Duluth in northwestern Wisconsin, a bridge that is 60 years old and long overdue for reconstruction. So those are the sort of things that you're seeing all over. You know, one of the things you don't see as easily is the broadband infrastructure, because when somebody goes from having dial-up service to having just high-speed access, that often happens within within somebody's home or within somebody's business. But that's making a huge difference, even though it's not as visible to the public as a major highway or road construction project.
Talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, looking at the two-year anniversary of the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the impact it's had on Wisconsin. Turning to today's news, Senator Baldwin, we saw the U.S. House, pass a continuing resolution for government funding. A different sort of model here, kind of dividing the budget into two different parts with different expiration dates. What do you think of that approach that's come from your colleagues over in the House?
Well, it's very non-traditional, but I think it's acceptable to those of us in the Senate, especially those of us like I have the privilege of serving on the Senate Appropriations Committee, where we have put forward all of our bills funding the various departments of government. All of our bills have passed through committee on very strong bipartisan bases. And the first four measures that the House continuing resolution contains are things that I think we can make progress on by the deadline and hopefully avert another threat of a shutdown in mid-January. So I think there's wide support for passing this continuing resolution as it comes over from the House of Representatives and getting on with our business of passing the appropriation bills that fund the departments of government.
Briefly, I want to talk to you about collegiality in both chambers of Congress. We saw two pieces of news yesterday, one from each chamber, a shoving incident between two Republican colleagues in the House, and then an apparent challenge to a fight from a sitting U.S. senator or one of your Republican colleagues aimed at someone testifying there. Do you have hopes that things can dial back from the level of apparent physical confrontation?
Yeah, this was it was very shocking. I was three seats away from the senator in question when he stood up to threaten a witness at one of our hearings. And I really think that it's frankly incumbent upon the Senate Republican leadership to intervene and make it absolutely clear that this is unacceptable for a sitting senator. It's at a time when there's so many divisions in our country, we need to have members of the Congress, members of the Senate, being role models of how to work together and get things done. And this was just the opposite and very, very unseemly.
Senator Baldwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. I talked to her yesterday about how Wisconsin is using its share of funding on the second anniversary of the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Up next, a congressional reporter shares the latest on the stopgap funding measure that pushes a shutdown deadline back to 2024. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Late Wednesday night, Congress passed a stopgap spending measure, narrowly avoiding a government shutdown, which is going to happen this weekend if lawmakers failed to take action. The deadline for settling the federal budget has been pushed back to early 2024, when the House and Senate will have to settle their differences again. House Speaker Mike Johnson, who put the plan forward, said he will no longer support stopgap funding measures after this, since he says they just delay an inevitable fight with the Senate. We're taking a look at the stopgap measure that'll keep the government funded through early next year and how we got there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the risk of government shutdown? Why do you think Congress keeps getting to the brink? Do you want to see changes in how they do this stuff? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginger Gibson is senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Ginger, we have this sort of two-tiered stopgap spending bill. It's a little different than what we usually see coming out of these. What did we end up with this time?
This time we ended up with really the United States Congress saying that they didn't have any fight left in them. It was only weeks ago when we thought that they might be on the brink of a shutdown. At the end of September, the start of October, they seemed to surprise us all at the last minute and pass that funding bill, that ultimately prompted the removal of Kevin McCarthy. And so they've spent the intervening weeks, the last 6 weeks, fighting more amongst themselves and trying to figure out how to keep the government funded. And that sort of culminated in this week, where they said that they would extend the government funding, pass Christmas, assure that they all can go home and have the holidays. And as you mentioned in your last segment with the senator, it really seemed on Capitol Hill today like they need that break because the tensions are high and nerves are frayed.
Now, Speaker Johnson managed to shepherd this through with Democratic support, and it looks like so far he's not going to be immediately ousted as his predecessor, Speaker McCarthy, was. Does that mean he has better blood with his caucus? Is it just they're tired of deciding who their leader is going to be? Why did he get a pass, at least for now?
I think it's a little bit of everything, right? They don't have the ill will towards Johnson that they had towards Kevin McCarthy. So some of the removal was bad blood between McCarthy and his detractors. That started from the day he was sworn in, and they were sort of looking for a last straw to sort of make them pull the trigger to remove him. So he doesn't have that bad blood. I think some of it's exhaustion. I think some of it is having watched what happens when you put up that fight and seeing the fallout maybe gave them less of an appetite for it. There's still a lot of open questions about what the political ramifications for Republicans are for the past 6 weeks. We can only hypothesize now, but there's a lot of hypothesizing going on Capitol Hill and a lot of questions left to be answered about whether or not they could pay some political price for really looking chaotic these last several weeks. And so I think Republicans, fearing that may be the case as well, has started to say, maybe not another round of this if our voters aren't so thrilled about it.
Let's bring on a caller. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a senior citizen. I've been retired for 10 years, and I can't believe this government keeps spending $1 trillion a year more than it brings in. We can't do this forever. Don't people realize that? We're turning into a third world country. We won't be able to pay our debts. We won't be able to pay our commitments. And we're not going to be able to maintain our military.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Ginger, some Republicans on Capitol Hill are echoing Mark's argument and saying, you know, it may not be ideal, but let's use these risks of shutdown and these budget stopgaps here. Let's use this for leverage for spending cuts. I assume that many Republicans are still arguing along those lines. Is that right?
That's right. I think Mark would find a lot of like-minded Republicans on Capitol Hill. I think the problem that Mark would find is that if he asked them afterwards what they planned to cut or what they wanted to cut or where they were going to make those reductions, they'd have a hard time finding answers. Lots of folks on Capitol Hill say deficit spending is not sustainable, that it is a national security risk to continue to spend at debt levels, but they just aren't willing to make the cuts. You know, Mark is retired. Is he worried about raising the retirement age? Is he worried about cutting Social Security benefits? Has less impact on him, but it does have an impact. And so those are the kind of places. Would Mark support really scaling back defense spending, shrinking the size of the Pentagon? I think that there are some people who would, but not everyone. And those are really hard things to figure out. And so the easy part is saying, let's shut down the government to try to force cuts. The hard part is finding cuts that you can get through both chambers of Congress.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. Ginger, over the years, we've seen, you know, bipartisan groups of members of Congress get together and try to come up with longer-term budget plans, try to come up with longer-term spending cuts. They, in some cases, get to the point of releasing a plan, and then, as you say, there's a lot of disagreement about it and nothing happens. Are people talking along those lines, trying to come up with some kind of grand bargain again?
I mean, there are discussions. We all remember sequestration. Maybe we don't all remember because maybe we blocked it out or you don't want to remember. But there was a period of time in the last decade where Congress tried to force cuts. They tried to cap spending, tying domestic spending to defense spending. This CR that was passed this week is going to extend funding for some parts of the government through like January 19th and the rest of it into February. And that is also sort of an idea to try to force some conversations, force some discussions. But it's really a difficult time, I think, to do that because at its core, Congress is really more polarized than they've ever been. I think we might not understand for a long time how much January 6th really divided their ability to come together. And it just doesn't seem on Capitol Hill at this point that there is an appetite or a climate to reach those type of grand bargains. And it's going to take a lot of work and it's going to take a lot of time. And at this point, no one has really started doing that hard work that I think would take to get the kind of bipartisan agreement you would need, particularly if one side, Republicans, say that raising taxes is completely off the table. I think that would be a real sticking point for Democrats and a place where they would have a hard time getting past.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital, about the latest averted government shutdown and the latest stopgap measure on the federal budget. back to your calls. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hello.
Hello. There's one thing that I'd like to point out, and this has been true since the so-called contract with America back in 94 that was made by Newt Gingrich and the Republican Party. Time and again, the government has been shut down, and we've gone to the brink over and over as far as passing budgets. And this just isn't healthy for the United States.
James, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We've seen, Ginger, some of those organizations that rate credit ratings nudge the U.S. credit rating down a bit, largely because of the shutdowns or near misses that James is talking about. In our last minute, consequences of running our budget this way.
I mean, there's going to be consequences for a long time, and I think we don't even fully understand what those consequences are going to be. How does it affect future policymaking? How does it affect future tax levels? What does it do to our ability to borrow? But also, I think it's important to think about the mindset that it has created. I mentioned earlier raising taxes. There's such a hard line against raising taxes, even in the wake of the ability to cut taxes or the having cut taxes, that it's really just made it the way it always was. And that starts changing the way we think about our spending and our taxation levels and really changes our country. And so there's long-term ramifications for this that I think we are still far away from understanding.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. We've been talking to Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor at NBC News Digital. She talked to us today about the stopgap spending measure that will at least temporarily fund the government. That goes through early 2024 when we'll be likely talking about this again. You can share your thoughts still. Email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Have you ever sat down one evening and thought to yourself, that was a day? If you wrote about that day, could its events, its trials, tribulations, highs, lows, mysteries, revelations fill an entire book? Our next guest has made an impressive literary career of filling books, big ones, with storytelling about a world of his own creation told from the perspective of a span of individual days. The same is true from his newest book, a standalone story that takes place in one day in his fictional world. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, a reader of fantasy fiction yourself? Have you ever worked to create your own fantasy world for a role-playing game, for your own writing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss is the author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. It kicked off with The Name of the Wind. His new book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires, set in the fictional world where his other novels take place. Fun fact, he was a guest on the pilot version of a radio show that eventually became this show. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, first off, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was I was an early adopter. But also, that was the best, nicest lead-in I have heard in a mortal age. I am so tickled, and I'm like really kind of blushy right now.
Oh, stop.
it's true. I never actually realized that. Yeah, I guess I do frame things in terms of days, which sounds silly now that I kind of admit that that wasn't intentional.
Wow. And I'll credit to our producer, Tim Peterson. I've read your books, but I didn't really until I thought back. It's like, yeah, the novels were told. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of people in Wisconsin familiar with your work. For those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about the world that The Name of the Wind and the new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires, is set in?
That is a dangerous one, and I'll try to do it briefly.
How much time do we have? Yeah,
exactly. Everyone out there just heard me say briefly, and they're rolling their eyes. Fantasy... if you look at Tolkien, he wrote what is referred to as secondary world fantasy. It happens somewhere else. There's a lot of modern fantasy is written in this world, but different, or this world, but there's secrets. When I sat down to start this whole project, gosh, 20 years ago, I knew I wanted to tell a story in another world, but the thing that I wanted to avoid is something I've seen in so many of the books that I loved, but it broke my heart. At the end of The Lord of the Rings, Middle Earth is kind of done. The story exhausts the world. There can't ever be follow-ups because, like, the elves are leaving, and the story is so big that there's no room for more things to happen after it in the world without seeming anticlimactic. So when I started writing this story, I'm like, I want to tell a smaller story about a man's life. You know, what's, like, I've heard it referred to as the backstage pass to the myth of the hero. But after I'm, you know, I always thought when I'm done telling this person's story, there's more world, more places, more people. So that's my world, is it is a fun place to explore, but hopefully big enough. I always hoped for multiple stories. That's not very descriptive at all.
That's okay. But I actually want to take it to this new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You've actually done exactly what you just talked about in this and a previous book, taken one character, a secondary character from the main arc, and said, in effect, what is a day in their life look like? And it's a very different feel and a very different voice, but it allows you to explore another part of that world you created.
And, you know, that was, it was something I stumbled into with Slow Regard, the book that should never have been written and I never thought would be published, the book where nothing happens, but that I love it anyway. And, you know, this one, at least I could think, well, people do want to show up for effectively, you know, you get to see a secondary character live their own life. There's a term for that sort of episode in a TV show, but I don't know it because I don't do TV shows.
I wanted to talk about the challenge of writing fantasy, and I'm always impressed with this fantasy and some science fiction where, as you said, it's set not in our world, where in addition to telling a story, you have to answer a lot of questions about how that world works, but also, I mean, and some old science fiction is, here's an encyclopedia chapter for the first chapter, so you know where we are. The challenge of, like, working all that world building in while still, you know, advancing a plot.
It is the persistent issue, and it's one, you know, we all love Granddaddy Tolkien, or we're in his shadow. And his shadow is long. And I love The Lord of the Rings, read it every year as a kid. It's got fingerprints all over my heart. But good Lord, that book starts slow, right? And he's like, hey, there's a place, and they have birthday parties, and they give gifts, and they're called Mathomes, and there's a museum. And so this guy is going to have a birthday, and here's what that birthday is like. And you're like, Tolkien, it's been 50 pages. What's going on here? And so what it's talked about in this day and age is you make this world because you have to make a world to tell a story in it. And then you're kind of proud of it and you want to show it off and you have to show it off. But, you know, the rookie mistake is to, again, follow a little too closely in Tolkien's footsteps and you show everything off and you're excited because your baby is very smart and pretty and you really want to talk about the cool religion you made or the magic you have. And it's called the info dump. In my experience, the problem isn't making a cool world. The problem is making it and then shutting up about it and doing a story instead. And I'm afflicted with it as much as anyone because I do a wild amount of world building.
Talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, author of the series that starts with The Name of the Wind. A new book set in that world is just out, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions, your experiences reading fantasy literature, and a question I'm about to ask Patrick is, what kind of stuff do you like to read to your kids? Do you have fond memories of having things read to you by your parents growing up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Pat, you were mentioning your reading of The Lord of the Rings as a kid. I know you've talked online and elsewhere about, you know, what you like to read to your own kids. What is on your hit list? What kind of things do you look for to read to kids?
I do. You know, for a long time, for those of you out there that know what Goodreads is, I used to review a lot of books there. And then as I started to read more to my boys and look more at kids' books, I shifted almost entirely to sharing my many, many opinions about children's literature, because good Lord, if you're a careful parent who wants to limit a child's exposure to some really toxic cultural stuff, there's a lot to look out for in some of these classic books. But yeah, I never knew that Little House on the Prairie was real or a book until I already had kids. So I read all of them to the boys, editing on the fly to avoid, oof, there are some racist and sexist things in there, but still they're fabulous. They're more fantastic than a lot of fantasy I've read. These days though, my boys are 9 and 14. And there's very little, like, in terms of like age range that I wouldn't lay on them. Think of who their daddy is, right? So I've read The Hobbit to him multiple times. They could practically sing along with the opening. Right now I'm rereading The Last Unicorn to them, one of my all-time favorite books. I read this book to them only because on a lark, I was reading Ursula K. Le Guin's like foundational Wizard of Earthsea, which I love and they love, but it was not meant to be read out loud and it was hard. And if you're doing it before bed, you don't want an extra job. And I'm like, maybe I could read them a little bit of Slow Regard, which I remembered being easy to read out loud because I did the audiobook. And I'm like, and I did it. And then I immediately got self-conscious and I said, you know what, boys, this was silly. I'm not going to read you my own. And they're like, please, please, please. And I read it. And they loved this story about nothing. They were so into it. And so I bounced this book off of them as well. And they helped me catch a few mistakes and they helped me work on the illustrations. So I read to them all the time. Not as much as I wish I would, but still an awful lot.
Yeah. We're talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss about some of his storytelling craft, including speculative fiction and world building, and his new book. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Have you already picked up the new book? Are you a writer yourself? Do you need maybe some inspiration for your own creativity? And do you have favorite things to read to kids? Or do you have a favorite memory of being read to as a kid? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss is with us talking about the craft of storytelling in his new book set in his fictional world. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to share a quick story of my aunt reading Shel Silverstein poems to us, my sister and I, and how much we just enjoyed that experience, how his words brought those poems to our imagination. And I forgot the titles. It's Another Light in the Attic, something like that. Perhaps the author knows.
A Light in the Attic. Yeah.
And John, I got to ask before I let you go, have you passed those on to a new generation or do you plan to?
Yes, we've kept them and I read them to my kids, but now my kids are 19, 21, 23. So we'll see. They'll be held on to for another generation.
That's for sure. My kids are that age. They don't let me read to them anymore either. But I had a great aunt who read Shel Silverstein to us as a kid. It's the poems that aunts read to kids, apparently, Pat.
Oh, Shel Silverstein just gave me like a tingle of joy. The boys would read some of that to each other. Mm. I also stumbled onto videos of Shel Silverstein reading his own stuff. which was wild. Like, it was not what I expected because he was an intense man.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Pat, in the new book, I get a little bit of a like a fairy tale feel to it for a couple of reasons, I think. Do you look to the worlds of fairy tales and folklore for some of your inspiration?
Absolutely. And for this one in particular, I kind of put my foot in it because I'm like, oh, you know, I actually studied fairy tales. I used to collect fairy tales. I'm like, back in my arrogant youth, I'm like, I just want to read all of the classic fairy tales, get them under my belt. You can't. There's so many and from all different cultures. However, when I'm like, I'll draw on some of those elements. And, you know, if you're, again, if I'm trying to fit some of those things into my world is not the world of, you know, medieval Europe, mm-hmm. or where the Grimm brothers were, or, you know, a lot of these, you know, this different mindset. So the cultural things don't fit together, but also trying to bring in and sort of be mindful of a different sort of morality, because these fairy tales were moral. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a great book. It's one of the few books written about fairy tales seriously, and it's called The Witch Must Die, because people think, oh, these were never meant for children. The thing is, yeah, they weren't meant just for children. Kids love them, and they don't mind terrible things in stories so long as the people who do terrible things are punished. And that sort of, it's reassuring because you're like, oh, there might be bad people, but they're going to get theirs. And like, and that is a more, I'm not saying it's the best morality, but there's a moral compass in there. And like the evil stepmother in Sleeping Beauty, at the end, she's safe. She's back. She's getting married. And at the wedding, they heat up a pair of iron shoes by the fire, make her wear them and dance until she dies. So like, that's old Testament morality, mm-hmm. there. But that doesn't really, you know, fit in the world I created. And it's not necessarily the morality that I want to spread in my own fiction. So, I mean, a little taste of that is fine, but I don't want that to be the end all be all. So trying to be socially responsible with what I'm sharing with the world, it's a little tricky because the old folk tales, they were dark, and fairies weren't really interested in important stuff like consent. And so I had some work to do there. Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just want to tell Patrick how much I enjoy his writing. I picked up The Name of the Wind. I don't know why I picked it. You know, but I loved it so much. I shared it with my whole family. And I just finished reading The Slow Regard again because I liked that so much. I saw it at the library. And now the mystery to me just called and said, your new book is in. Could I come and get it? So that's what I'm doing.
Barbara, who gave you a call?
The Murder to Me bookstore, I think she was referring to.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. Patrick, you're at a point where you've got lots of fans out there. What does it feel like to, I don't know, just to have people out there looking forward to something, as Barbara did clearly, to picking up that book at the bookstore today?
You know, the proper answer is sort of the chirpy Hollywood interview answer, which is to say, oh, it's so great. And it is. I'm not saying that's not a true answer, but the really true answer is it's been like almost a decade since I published a book, and I've really felt bad about that. And I've beaten myself up about it. And there's books I've wanted to write, and there's books that people want to read from me. And then I do this book, and I know it's not the book some people want or wish for. And so it's not healthy, but I will admit, like, somebody asked me this exact question. Hey, you're getting a book out. How does it feel? Pretty good. And I'm like, actually, I have a sense of dread.
Oh, no.
Because I'm worried people will just be upset. It's not what they want. And but hearing from people like that, I remember, like, you don't do things for the people that are going to be angry at you. Like, that shouldn't be my deciding thing. It's been so nice to hear it again and again as I put the book out. Some people are salty. It's not what they wanted, or it's been too long for them. But there's so many people who are kind and thoughtful, and they understand that life gets in the way. And it does me a world of good to hear that people still think of me fondly, honestly. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. I think I said murder to me, mystery to me bookstore. Talking to Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. His latest book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires. It's been a while since we talked, Patrick, but I dimly recall that you really liked recommending books and sharing the stuff you're loving reading with other humans. You got any suggestions for us these days?
You know, when you're promoting a book, you know what your PR people hate is when you talk about another book that's coming out right now. But man, I'll do it every time. If you haven't read Murderbot, the Murderbot Diaries, I think I love it as much as I've loved anything that I've read that I've picked up new in these last 5 years. And you might think, what, Murderbot? That, ooh, no. I read a lot, and I don't know if I have loved anything as much as I've loved that. I've read it multiple times. The audiobook is stunning by Kevin R. Free. It's by Martha Wells. And the newest one, Me and My Boys, honestly, I've been kind of excited and kind of dreading my own book release. The book release we've really been looking forward to in this household with untrammeled joy is Martha Wells' new Murderbot. Start at the beginning though, and trust me, it's gorgeous. I've never empathized with a character as much as I've empathized with Murderbot.
All right, I will apologize to your PR people, Patrick.
No, I love it. Thank you for giving me the chance, because I'll talk about Murderbot all day. I would list 100 books, but I know that I shouldn't mention a book that's coming out literally right now. But absolutely, pick that one up, then you can try mine.
And then go ahead. Yeah. Well, actually, I just want to ask briefly in our last half a minute or so, Patrick, you've taught creative writing, including at your alma mater, UW-Stevens Point, over the years. Quick bit of inspiration for somebody who wants to write for, you know, maybe they're going to publish a book, maybe it's just for fun, a quick bit of inspiration for them.
I'll say this. There's no right way to do it. And anyone who says this is the way, take their advice with a grain of salt. Instead, if you want to make a world, don't feel like you got to do what Tolkien did. He was a linguist, so he did languages. He was a historian, so he based it on the Eddas. If you love stamp collecting and butterflies, and that's what you're into, make a world that centers around that, and I will be there for your weird Lepidoptera fantasy novel, man.
That, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
That's Wisconsin-born and raised Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series, which kicked off with The Name of the Wind. We talked to him about his latest book called The Narrow Road Between Desires and many other things as well. If you have a favorite book that you like reading to kids, email ideas@WPR.org. We can share it on a future program.